Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Franz Duval. He is the C.H. Candler Professor in Emory University's Psychology Department and director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. And we're talking about his newest book, Mama's Last Hug: Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Professor Duval, let's talk about the title of this book, because it refers to a very specific incident that really sums up everything that you're talking about in this book.
Yeah, it refers to a video that went viral of an encounter between my own professor, Jan van Hoof, who's still alive. He was 80 years at the time, and Mama, the chimpanzee, who was the alpha female of a very large, actually the world's largest colony, captive colony of chimpanzees. And so Mama was dying at the age of 59, and normally we never go in with an adult chimpanzee because that's potentially very dangerous. But he went in with her to say goodbye, and she embraced him, he embraced her. She had an enormous facial expression, she made some sounds, she patted him on the back and so on. And people were very touched by it.
I cried.
Yeah. And well, for me it was even more touching because I know her and I know him. So I think that people were touched is completely understandable, but people were also surprised. And that is what sort of got me, is that why are people surprised that her facial expressions and her gestures are so extremely human-like?
Right.
Because they also have the same emotions. And so I felt I needed to explain more about how primates express their emotions and what the range of emotions is, because I don't think everyone knows that.
Now, before we go on, we should explain that the words emotions and feelings are not synonymous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, feelings are private states. So you can tell me about your feelings, but even then I have trouble. So you may say that you're happy, or you may say that you're sad. How do I know that your happiness is exactly like my happiness? So your feelings are sort of inaccessible to me, and certainly true for animals. I cannot know the feelings of a chimpanzee or of a dog. I can guess at them, of course. I can make a good guess, but I cannot know them. Now, emotions are expressed in the body. Emotions are always expressed in your heart rate, your blood pressure, your skin temperature, your facial expressions, your voice. Your body picks up the emotions and expresses them, and that's why the emotions can be measured. We can measure the emotions in animals very clearly. It's really no problem. It's the feelings that is really a problem for us.
Now, it's important to realize, and the audience to realize, these are scientific observations that you're making. As a matter of fact, you describe mm-hmm. observation as your profession. Mm-hmm. And for you, observation trumps any theory. And that's always been the problem, it seems, with science considering emotions in animals. There's all been these theories, but it's never been based on actual observation.
No, that's the problem. There's a lot of terms that we use, like consciousness, for example. People will say only humans have consciousness. Well, if you want to make a claim like that, you need to very clearly define what consciousness is. And then I will measure it in an elephant, and I will tell you if the elephant has it, yes or no. But as long as people don't come up with a clear definition, I'm not ready to make any statements about the elephant. And so my own consciousness, of course, I know, but that's the only one I know. You may, for all I know, you may be a zombie or
that's right.
Or a robot. I don't know what you are.
I'm not. But I'm not.
Okay.
But this is the problem. We're also working against a long legacy of humanity's low opinion of animals, emotional and mental capabilities. I mean, when I took ethology in college oh so many decades ago, we were warned against, I mean, virtually beaten into our heads about something called anthropomorphizing. And it was the time, it was the rule of the behaviorists. And boy, we should never, ever make any assumption that would lead to these kinds of conclusions. But it seems like through people like yourself and other scientists now that we're starting to work in and show a much more complex attitude towards the emotional life of an animal.
Yeah, so the anthropomorphizing criticism, which was so common at the time and still is, would also prevent us from using very common sense language. Like if two chimpanzees after a fight kiss and embrace, I would call that a reconciliation. But they would say, no, no, you have to call it a post-conflict contact. because they want you to stay away from human terminology, because that connection with humans we should never make. And the result is that we have this whole vocabulary of terminology that is that keeps a distance between us and other species that is totally unnecessary, in my opinion, and is actually anti-Darwinian, you would say, because, of course, we are closely connected with a lot of species.
There's an interesting phrase in your book, and this relates to this, and throughout the book, the reader will find this out. Looking at an ape reveals our shared history, not only to us, but also to the ape looking back at us. If the apes are time machines for us, then we are the same for them. And that it's that going back and forth and seeing the similarities that is amazing in this book, and example after example.
Yeah. People often present the chimpanzee as this is a way for us to look back at our history. But, you know, the chimpanzee, since the time point that we split from them, they have been evolving. They have been changing, too. We may have changed more. That is true, because we started walking bipedally, and we got this huge brain. And so maybe there were more changes in our lineage than in the chimpanzee, but both of us have been changing.
Well, you know, and one of the derogatory phrases you'll hear is, well, they were about as smart as a four-year-old human. And when you describe the social life, say, for instance, of mama's life as an alpha female, man, she's got an incredibly complex life that she had to lead as the alpha female of the troop of chimpanzees.
Yeah, the thing is that I think comparing human children with ape children is perfectly fine because they're both playful, they don't worry about the future, they are dependent on adults. In that sense, there's a lot of comparison. But if you take an adult chimpanzee, that's not like a child, a human child. An adult male is interested in power and sex. An adult female is mostly interested in her offspring and keeping them safe and having them fed. And so there are very adult concerns, and they do worry about the future. There's actually a lot of evidence now.
That's right.
That the apes can think ahead, and they probably also worry about what's going to happen to them. So, yeah, that's more like an adult pattern.
What I was struck by is that how chimps do things, like if there's been a fight or an argument or some sort of vicious outbreak between two of the chimps in the group, after that's over, they'll work to sort of resolve the conflict, to calm the other chimps down and get everything back to normal. And it's amazing to read about that.
Yeah. That's all my life I've worked on reconciliation after fights.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I myself am from a family of six boys, and so maybe I was familiar with it before I started my studies. And we have now found reconciliation in all sorts of species, not just the primates, in dogs, in dolphins, in elephants, you name it. All social animals have ways of repairing relationships after confrontations that occur.
Now, people may say, okay, maybe animals and apes have certain kinds of basic emotions, but these more complex emotions like disgust and self-restraint and self-regulation or empathy, those are things that only humans can feel. How do you answer that?
Yeah, I think all the evidence, and that's the book is really about all of that, all the evidence points in the direction that there are no uniquely human emotions. Maybe spirituality or some, I don't know, there may be a few, but most of them, I compare them with our organs. I don't have a single organ in my body that you don't find in the body of your dog, like heart and lungs and kidneys and brains. You find it, all of the organs of the mammals are basically the same, and I would say the same thing for the emotions. We may have a few emotions that are more sophisticated or more elaborated, but that doesn't mean that they're fundamentally new emotions.
And they can feel more complex emotions. Like you have a great example of one of the chimps digging up a dead rat, I think it was, and then sneaking up behind other chimps and laid on their back. Talk about that, because that was – I'm reading – every example I read in your book just sort of surprises me.
Well, there was a female named Tara who had a hobby of when she would find a dead rat, she would immediately see the use of it, and she would pick it up by the tail and hold it away from her body. She doesn't like – necessarily these dead rats, and she would then place it very carefully on a sleeping chimp and walk away, and from a distance she would watch what happened, and that chimp of course would either smell or feel, and and would jump up, and they would be very upset, and they would try to clean themselves off the dead rat, which was basically she was playing with the emotion of disgust that others have. And then she would pick up her rat and go to the next one.
Was she enjoying that? Was she like playing a prank?
Yeah, I think that we immediately see how that could be funny, and I think she probably found it funny too. And I discuss a little bit the sense of humor of animals.
It's complicated.
I don't think animals only laugh, because chimpanzees do laugh only when they're tickled. I think there are also certain amusing situations where they may laugh.
Well, one of the first things you bring up about laughing is that it's never a simple emotion. It's not just like you're having a great time. It's much more complex, even for us. It's got many nuances.
Yeah, we have all sorts of laughs. Of course, you have laughs. Not all laughs are about humor or jokes or funny things, because we laugh also when we have just a discussion with someone and he says something completely ordinary and we still laugh. So we laugh under all sorts of circumstances. We may have aggressive laughs. We may laugh at people.
There's a nervous laugh. There's a laugh when you're not really sure what's going on and you laugh.
Oh, yeah. And there's inappropriate laughs. Where you laugh at a funeral and then everyone stares at you.
You quoted Mary Tyler Moore show in the book, which
that's a very interesting scene, because he keeps laughing and she cannot stop, especially because everyone stares at her and so she cannot stop anymore.
There's the amazing thing about animals laughing is that you give an example of a rat that learned to love to get tickled.
Yeah, this is the studies of Jaak Paksepp, who did a lot of neuroscience on animal emotions, and he said the emotions are deep in the brain. It's not the prefrontal cortex, which we always emphasize in our species, but the emotions are very deep in the brain, and he says that rats have all these emotions. And one of the things he started to do is tickle his rats, and he then documented their sounds, because normally we cannot hear the ultrasonic vocalizations of the rat. And so he designed an apparatus that brought them down in frequency. So you could hear the rat laughing, and you could see that they actually like to be tickled, because he would move his hand away and the rats would be running after his hand, basically, to be tickled.
Now, what about something like empathy? Do we have some kind of scientific evidence or observational evidence that at least the higher animals, higher mammals can feel empathy? Because that seems like a very human emotion.
Well, empathy is that you are sensitive to the emotions of somebody else, and you may adopt them or you may react to them. And I think all the mammals have that. So, for example, the most common expression is what we call consolation. Someone is distressed, and you go over, you embrace them, and you calm them down. Something that parents do with their kids the whole day, basically, it seems.
Yep.
So consolation has been seen now in all the mammals. So in rodents, in dogs. Actually, the reason the dog is man's best friend, I'm sure, is because the dog is in tune with our emotions and reacts to our emotions. And so all the mammals have that capacity. And then you have more complex parts of empathy, where you can understand the situation of somebody else or imagine the situation. That's maybe not present in rodents, and I don't know about your dog, but these more complex forms I think we see in some species like elephants and apes and so on.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Franz De Waal. He is the C.H. Candler Professor in Emory University Psychology Department and Director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. And we're talking about his newest book. It's one of those books that will really change the way you look at things. Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Professor De Waal, after reading the book, and you have a really interesting last chapter, you talked about consciousness. At the end, you have to start asking yourself, after reading all these examples, does this say something about sentience? And can we define things like consciousness and sentience? And do we have any idea or even a clue, and how would we go about investigating that in animals?
Yeah, that's a big puzzle, is that we have invented the word consciousness without defining it. It's really not very helpful, I think.
Yeah.
So my guess is that there are certain things that we humans cannot do without consciously thinking about it, and that if animals then can do it, we have to think about their consciousness. So, for example, you cannot plan a party for tomorrow with your friends without really thinking about what you should buy and who you're going to invite. And so you have to consciously think about your plan. We know now from many studies on certain birds, the corvids, and the primates, that they can plan ahead. You can give them a task for which they can get a tool that they can only use the next day. So people do these experiments in the wild. We also have observations of chimpanzees planning ahead for the next day. And so if they can plan, if they can make plans, I assume that it is in a very similar way than that we make plans. And so consciousness is probably involved. And so we have a whole bunch of these tasks that we do now with animals, cognitive tasks, that we humans cannot solve without consciously thinking about it, which probably means that the animals are also consciously thinking about it.
One of the things that towards the end of the book, you talk about the three reasons humans should respect all life. And I just want to talk about that because it's a sensible list. The inherent dignity of all living things, what does that mean?
Well, I think we need to respect all life. There is, of course, certain life that bothers us, let's say a mosquito in your
right.
bedroom. I will kill the mosquito, I must say. So I don't follow my rules to the letter. And so there are certain situations where I deviate from these rules. But I think in principle, we should respect all life forms as much as we can. And we have a tendency to respect more intelligent life. And longevity is also an issue. So for example, if a tree is very old, we have more respect for the tree than for a young tree. That's interesting that we have that,
yeah, I know that.
Bias.
Yeah. But there's also interest, every form of life has in its own existence and survival that we need to recognize. And now this, and you, I love the fact that you address this in this book. This doesn't mean we all have to be vegetarians at all, because the normal thing of life is to be omnivorous for many species, including the higher apes. But we need.
Yeah, I'm a biologist, and I think biologists are very aware of the circle of life and how all sorts of organisms eat all sorts of other organisms. And so for me, the eating part is not really the issue. It's the treatment part. How do we treat the animals that we do eat? And there's an enormous room for improvement, as we all know.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're not doing a good job on that. And my ideal world would be that we cut the meat consumption in half.
Right.
And the other animals that we do still eat, we treat them better. And maybe in the future, even further in the future, we're going to have artificial meat. So that would be even ideal. Then real animals are not involved anymore. Then we just produce it in some factory or something.
And the third one is recognizing the sentience and the capacity for suffering of animals. And, you know, I hear this all the time from people that there is some evidence that even fish can suffer.
Yeah. So there's animals like crabs and fish that they have tested on tasks. For example, the crab study.
That was wild.
They shine bright lights on the crabs, and the crabs then hide in crevices, and they get electrical shocks in certain places. And very soon thereafter, the crabs are going to avoid these places where they have gotten shocks, which means that they must have had a negative experience. And sentience is defined as that you can have positive and negative experiences. And so even the crabs and the fish, there's now basically the consensus is that all animals with brains basically have sentience.
Where do you see the next level of observation and experiments going to understand animal emotions and animal inner life?
Well, I think there's a lot of neuroscience coming up, and the neuroscientists have been quite active in the area of animal emotions, but also in the observational studies and the field studies that we do, we need to pay more attention to the emotions. We have sort of stayed away from it because the term was taboo. And so you could describe emotional scenes, but you would not mention the word emotion because the behaviorists in the previous century, they insisted so much that we should never use that kind of terminology. And I think we are now more open, and there's an enormous amount of data that we don't have yet and that we need to collect on it.
Is part of the problem the word consciousness? It seems like we're never going to get a definition of that. I mean, I don't. After decades, I'm still not sure what the definition of consciousness is.
No, and people write in entire books about it.
I know. I've interviewed them.
Yeah, or they they say that the more neurons you have in the brain, the more conscious you must be.
Yeah.
But then recently we discovered that actually elephants have three times as many neurons as we do. And then everyone sort of fell silent and didn't know what to say anymore. But there are animals with an enormous amount of neurons, more than we have. And so if that's the story, then we need to assume consciousness also.
Well, is part of this also just sort of giving up our role as the crown of creation, quote unquote, human exceptionalism? That seems to be what drives a lot of this, is that no matter what, we always have to put humans at the top of some kind of ladder. And it just seems that's like the wrong kind of metaphor to be thinking about life on Earth.
Yeah, instead of a ladder, I think we have a tree with many branches and many specializations, and some animals are specialized in intellect, like the corvid, the crow family, or the primates, or us, or dolphins. Some animals are specialized in big brains, and that's their niche, but just other animals who have other capacities that are not necessarily so intellectual. And we have all these specializations going on, and we need to pay attention to all of them instead of just the one that we have. And so we are very impressed with language, for example. That's one of our strengths, is we have language, symbolic language, and that's very specialized, I think. And so we, in the beginning, all the studies on animal cognition were looking, can they speak? Can we teach them how to? Yeah, so that was the focus that we had, very anthropocentric. We wanted them to be like us, basically.
And they're like themselves. They're like themselves. Yeah. And we're going to end on that note. My guest tonight has been Franz De Waal. He is the C.H. Candler Professor at Emory University's Psychology Department and Director of Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primates Research Center. And we've been talking about a very important book, Mama's Last Hug.
Thank you.
Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Franz De Waal, thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.